Welcome to our Goals to podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're delving into history writing. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Goldster Inside Story. I'm really thrilled today to welcome Midge Gillies, who is the author of this gorgeous new book, Piccadilly, The Circus at the Heart of London. And I'm loving it. I haven't completely finished reading it, but I'm absolutely loving it. It is beautifully written, has such a great story. And Midge, welcome. Tell us, what was it about Piccadilly that fascinated you?
Well, hello, and it's very nice to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. Well, I think it was probably something that had always been in my psyche. So my mum was from Balham, and she used to talk very kind of wistfully about going to Piccadilly Circus, and particularly going to the Lions corner house and tea shop with her sister. And it seemed like it was this kind of magical world, and they'd go in and be served by a better class of waitress, as my mum always said. They'd have just lovely times, and it would be affordable, and they'd have confidences. And then I used to go up to, when I was living and working in London, I would always kind of make a beeline for Piccadilly Circus because it felt like it was the kind of hub of London. And I think it's an interesting place because of where it sits geographically, because it's kind of on the edge of so many different parts of London. So if you think about it, you've got shopping. If you head up to Oxford Circus, then going further northeast, you've got Soho, which has, you know, traditionally had quite a kind of sleazy reputation. And then going round the clock, as it were, you've got Parliament. You've got Trafalgar Square with demonstrations. Then Piccadilly itself, which was kind of way out of my league because it was kind of posh clubs and that kind of thing. But it always felt very kind of exciting. And I think Eros, as it was wrongly called, the Shaftesbury Memorial statue, is such a wonderful place for meeting people and sitting and listening and watching. And I also, I did a PhD, and I did a lot of looking at oral history, particularly in the Second World War. And I got to know what happened in the Café de Paris, which is in Coventry Street, which is that, if you played Monopoly, you'll know it's a little yellow card. and there was a nightclub there, which claimed it was blitzproof because it was below pavement level. And unfortunately, a high explosive bomb came down the ventilation shaft and killed lots of people. And it became this real kind of cause celebre. So I was kind of intrigued at all these things that were going on in Piccadilly Circus and how it embraced things like hotels and shopping and transport and social change, and just was kind of quite edgy and fascinating, really. So that's a rather long answer to why I got drawn into it.
Well, it's wonderful because you see so many books about London, and you know, and I love London. I love the history of London. But to actually see one specific area was just such a fascinating idea. And through it, you can tell so many different stories. I mean, it was such a great choice to choose that bit and be able to put in all these different strands and to show how much of it knits there. And I love the way that you talk about, you know, Soho on one side and then Mayfair on the other, which is totally, you know, out of almost everyone's league. And then it's this wonderful piece in the middle. Did you grow up in London yourself? Were you born in London like your mum?
No, I spent the first 2 years of my life in Pinner. So I'm a sinner from Pinner. And then my parents waited 17 years for me. And my dad, who was Scottish, said that when my mum finally conceived, it was a good year for whiskey, that the year I was born. And then because I was a very spoilt and longed for only child, they said they thought they should take me out of London, the wicked London. So I grew up in Suffolk. But as I said, my mum's family was from Balham, and I lived and worked in London for quite a long time as well. So I kind of feel drawn to it as well places. Yeah.
And so you've written lots of other books, which we're going to talk about as well in a little while. But for this particular one, how long did it take you, and what was your process when you decided you wanted to write about Piccadilly?
Well, it was quite a different process because of the pandemic. So I got so first of all, I just wanted to write about the Café de Paris because I wanted to tell everyone's story of that night. And my fantastic editor at Two Roads said, well, that's interesting, but I think you, so it was really her idea, I think you should do the whole of Piccadilly Circus. And that really appealed to me because I like writing about maybe the people who aren't traditionally reported on, whose kind of stories slip through the chinks of history. So that would be really people like my families, because they didn't leave diaries or letters. So I wanted to be able to talk about social history and to write about things like shop girls and waitresses, as well as the posh people too. So I wrote quite a long proposal, which my agent took to my editor. So I'd already, my proposal, and it'd be interesting to see how long your proposals are, Lucinda, was about 10,000 words, which is the longest.
Wow, yeah. I've
written. So it gave me a shape of it. And then I remember my husband, I was like, oh, I must go to the Café de Paris, I must go there. And my husband said, you should go there quite soon. I said, no, I've got to be in the right state of mind. I need to have done all of my research. What could possibly stop me going to the Café de Paris?
Oh, no.
And then there was a pandemic. I remember also going with a friend to the Zidell's, the kind of bistro, yeah, which used to be the Regent Palace Hotel. And it felt like how it probably must have been on just before the fall of Paris in the Second World War, because we were aware that the tears were going to come in and there was going to be a complete lockdown. And it felt like we were kind of having this very special meal. And then when lockdown came, I remember going to the university library in Cambridge and just taking as many books out as I could and thinking, you know, who knows what's going to happen. And then so I did a lot of my research I bought a lot more books than I probably would have done. Lots of things were digitized, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. But yeah, also when things did open up, it was almost like a kind of smash and grab. So I remember going to the London Metropolitan Archives and thinking, right, I've just got to go in there and get as much as I can because I don't know when I'll be allowed back. So it was a much more kind of frantic way of approaching this book. And in the past, I would have spent a whole year doing my research. And then when I felt ready, I would start writing. But with this one, I did as much research as I could. And then I wrote a chapter and then carried on because I didn't know what I would have access to. Mm-hmm. And then did several lots of edits at the end. So it was quite a different process from with my other books.
And did you prefer this process, or will you be happy to go back to your normal process?
I quite liked it because it's less exhausting.
Yeah, so that's a good point.
Yeah, because in the past, you get to the end of the book and you think, I remember in the past saying to my husband, right, I'm going to write a letter to myself saying, you must never do this again. It's too exhausting and it's too stressful. And if you ever think you want to write another book, just don't do it. Remember and now I feel, I've got another book deal, which is wonderful. And I'm going to be actually doing writing as I go along because it's just it's more fun, you know, and to leave the writing to the end is almost quite kind of, punishing, because writing's hard work, but it's also joyful as well. So I think when I've written, I've read and feel enthusiastic about something, I will write different scenes and then sew them together at the end.
And how, for example, did you plot this particular one? Did you kind of go through, I'd love to know your process of physically kind of putting it together. Did you do a very long plot or did you just start writing organically?
No, well, I had, as I say, quite a detailed proposal, which had the chapter outline. And in the past, that's been a bit of a fantasy, really. You know, if anyone said to me, but you said in your proposal to do this, because, you know, writing is organic. Yes. But I did keep revising my proposals. I was thinking of it as a biography of a place. So I was thinking of who are the major characters in this story. So I would say that Eros is one of the key characters, and he goes right the way through, really, from when he was erected in 1893 right until the model for that figure, Colarossi, wanders through the Second World War. So he becomes quite a kind of he has quite a kind of safe life compared to the god that he represents. And he was used to promote war bonds in the Second World War. So I come back to him at various points. But then I thought about the themes I wanted to cover. And in the end, it was kind of plotted in a broad chronology, but also thinking about light, because light is so important in Piccadilly Circus. So I talk about the dim out and the black out and lights up, because there's quite a lot about theatre and film in it as well, and Piccadilly being a kind of a stage in a sense, a set for stories.
So you talk about some wonderfully nostalgic names like Swan and Edgar. Where exactly was Swan and Edgar? Where was the, was it the Rainbow Club or the Rainbow Corner? Or
Yeah. So Swan and Edgar is the frontage is still there in Piccadilly Circus, but there's kind of nothing as it were before, and this still exists as a brand. But it was this amazing department store, which people would go to and have tea there and have, meet up with their boyfriend or their girlfriend. And I feature it at the beginning because it was quite revolutionary, because it went from having quite tiny shop windows to having huge windows, because plate glass was technologically possible. And there was a character called Frozo, who was like a living statue that we often see in Leicester Square. Now, there's people who stand for ages and pretend to be different people. And so this character was in the shop window of Swan and Edgar, and he didn't move. And people couldn't work out if he was an automaton or a doll or a person. And there was a reward to try and make him move, because he's very good at being still. And there were huge crowds appeared, and they had to close the window because they thought they were going to smash it. And meanwhile, he kind of snuck out and got the bus home. So he was an interesting person. Rainbow Corner, also no longer there, but that was in a wonderful place for GIs to go to during the Second World War. And it was seen as a home from home. And they said that because it was open the whole time, they threw away the key.
I love that comment. Did they actually physically kind of stand and have a ceremony where they threw away the key?
They couldn't, when they had to actually lock it, they couldn't find the key. So I think they probably did. So they had to recreate a key.
Wow.
And for that, there was some wonderful stuff. And I got to speak to Petula Clark, who performed there as a very young girl, and kind of reminded the GIs of their, the family at home. And that was just absolutely thrilling to speak to her.
What did she say? It must have been fascinating.
She was amazing. And she just said, well, it still is the centre of London. And at the time, just before lockdown, she was appearing in Mary Poppins. And she said every time she walks through there, she thinks about the war and about the sandbags and how she was there again as a very young girl performing the Criterion, but below a ground, and how she was kind of holding things together because other children were really kind of, really disturbed when there was a loud bang, as you would be in the Second War. I always think that Downtown sounds a bit, the lyrics make me think of Piccadilly Circus as well, the kind of the lights and the rain and how that affects how the lights look.
Yeah, I love that idea that is what Downtown is all about, is actually about Piccadilly Circus.
Yeah.
I'm going to put a link here in the thing for where people can get hold of Piccadilly. And I love the fact the subtitle, The Circus at the Heart of London. I don't know if anybody else is aware of the poetry on the tube. I don't know if many of you have seen that when you've been in London. I remember years ago there was a poem, and I wish I could remember the name of the poet, about how excited she was as a child being taken to Piccadilly Circus because she thought there was going to be a big top. And they came out of the tube, and it's just this lovely, charming poem. And I wish I could remember the name of the poet. If anyone knows it, please put it in the chat. But I think that's that kind of name conjures up the idea of excitement. And what you've done in this book is you've made it feel like there is that excitement about that kind of circus feel to it, of the people from all over the world who congregate there.
Yes, I like the idea of it being quite a chaotic place, and also think of it as almost a roulette wheel, that you can come as one person and just for a night be someone else. So there are lots of stories about people who really changed overnight, literally, or embraced things that they wouldn't have done if they'd been safely at home. So I think it's a place for trying on new personas for size and experimenting with your own life.
And if anybody who is taking part, if there's any Goldstone members here, would like to put any memories of their own of Swan and Edgar, Piccadilly Circus, the Rainbow Club, any of these names we've been talking about, I'm sure that Midge would love to hear your stories as well.
Absolutely.
So you talk about all these kind of iconic, you never know, you might feature in the next book. You talk about Eros. Let's start with Eros, as you do. And I was thrilled. I just have to say this. Thank you for getting Princess Louise in there. So as Midge knows, and some of you may know, I wrote a biography of the artist, the sculptor, Princess Louise. And when I started reading about Alfred Gilbert, I was thinking, I hope Princess Louise in there because they're very good friends. And there she was. She appears. So I was absolutely thrilled. So thank you for that.
Well, of course, how could she not be in it?
Exactly. So tell us about Eros. What is his real name? And what does this statue mean? What was it like when it was unveiled?
So it's as you know, it's well, the sculptor Alfred Gilbert said it was Anteros, so it was his brother, and who symbolizes selfless love, which is quite different. And at the time when the statue was unveiled, it was claimed that it was the only aluminium statue in the world. And I do think it's a beautiful thing, but people were quite baffled by it. They didn't know whether it was Cupid or Eros or Mercury. And because of where the statue is, and at the time it had a reputation as a gay haunt, a place for, as the term was, prostitutes to arrive there as well. So it was seen as maybe a slightly dodgy god to choose and a statue to choose if you're going to be remembering Lord Shaftesbury. Who I was taught about at school as someone who was a social reformer and stopped children being sent up chimneys in kind of shorthand. So there was already this kind of tension between what did this statue symbolise and was it, you know, in keeping with the area, which had a slightly, you know, awkward reputation. And originally it was planned to be at Cambridge Circus, so at the other end of Shaftesbury Avenue, which would have been, I think, quite different. And yeah. Gilbert was quite moaned a bit about how it wasn't the ideal place to have a statue. And, you know, there were other things like the men's toilets, which he had to think of. And it was quite a troubling, from the start, a troubling commission. And he thought that he was going to be given melted down metal for the base of the statue, then had to pay for that himself and got into terrible debt. And he was, you know, he was a typical kind of cliched artist, and he was a real perfectionist. So he got into awful debt and would ask for commissions back because he didn't think they were good enough. And in the end, he fled to Bruges and had quite a sad life, and had to resign from the Royal Academy. And then his reputation was kind of somewhat rejuvenated later in his life. So I think he's a really interesting character, and he's involved in lots of kind of royal scandals as well.
Yes, absolutely. I will reveal one of those, because Princess Louise, when she was allegedly making love to her lover, Joseph Edgar Boehm, in the studio next door to Alfred Gilbert's studio, he died during the process. And Alfred Gilbert was, this is one version of a story that has many versions. Alfred Gilbert became her confidant and helped her when she had to kind of come up with a story. And so Alfred Gilbert really took the fall, and they became very good friends. In fact, she gave him her sculpting studio in the grounds of Kensington Palace when he was bankrupt to work in. But this was the naughty 90s when Eros or Anteros was put up. We tend to look back and think, well, everybody felt that way. But of course, this was still the Victorian age.
Oh, yes.
That kind of this gorgeous, naked young man at the top of this statue must have still caused a real controversy, as you say. What was the reason that Gilbert himself decided to do that particular style, that particular pose, to use Colarossi as his model?
Well, I think he was someone who always liked to experiment with different materials, and he was well known as someone who could make a material look as though it was living and breathing and moving. And I mean, he kind of veered off from his brief, so I'm not sure why he ended up where he did. But he also had there were lots of controversy about whether there was enough water in the fountains around it, and whether the flower girls who were regulars there were being soaked by it. And some of those young boys who Shaftesbury would have protected came and, you know, were ran right there and stole some of the cups that were there. Because one of the briefs was that there should be drinking water for dogs, you know. Actually, lots of dogs on the cover of my book, because it's by Larry. But, you know, it's not Piccadilly Circus, not well known for its dogs, really, is it? so it was from the start, it was very controversial. And I think he despaired, really, about it. And George Bernard Shaw was very rude about it. And, you know,
so he's rude about everything.
Yeah. but I mean, I can't imagine it, Piccadilly Circus, without Eros now, and it's probably one of the most famous statues in the world, I would think.
Yeah.
And people, you know, when they first come to London, make a beeline for it. And it's, you know, and I remember when I was doing the research, it was when England was playing Scotland in the football. And I had to go and look at Eros. And sure enough, there was a Scottish fan trying to get to the top of Eros, because that was what used to happen. People would actually get on top of him. And, you know, that's why he had to be taken down and repaired several times. And it's quite high up.
Yeah.
And Scottish fan just touched his foot and then came down about very carefully. So
is it a kind of good luck thing to touch Eros's foot?
Well, I think it's more kind of, they were normally fans are, you know, quite inebriated. So it's more that you need to get to the top, and it may be something to do with, you know, Scotland being at the top, even if they haven't won the football match. I don't know. I'm half Scottish, so I'm a bit biased in that.
We've got a couple of comments that have come in here. One says, I used to work in Haymarket and the Ritz. Ooh, very swish. I loved the vibrancy of the area. And another says, I worked in Old Bond Street and later Swallow Street off Piccadilly in the 1970s. Spent all my lunchtimes in Piccadilly Circus, especially in Swan and Edgar. I absolutely loved it. And I still remember that thrill I felt as I emerged there from the underground every morning. And I think that kind of sums up what you're saying in the book, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I still feel that thrill when I come up from the tube, because I think Piccadilly Circus works on so many different levels, because the tube itself is absolutely beautiful and has retained many of the original features. And then you come up and it's still so bright. You know, it's always been one step ahead of technology, so that the digital screen is really bright. And then you've got amazing architecture, lots of different architecture. So you look at it and you see it at different levels. So I still have to stop myself going, oh, you know, feeling like a real country bumpkin when I go there. And Swan and Edgar's was an amazing shop, and it was places that Mari Lloyd, the music hall performer, would go to have her beautiful gowns made. So it's a place that I don't really think we've got its like anymore because of online shopping and those kinds of things.
Yeah, definitely. Would you mind doing a little reading from the beginning about your own experience?
Sure. So this is right at the start. I'll try and position this so I'm not blocking my voice. And it's really explaining why I was taken by Piccadilly Circus. I remember the first time I visited Piccadilly Circus. It was the 1970s, and my mother and I took the train from Suffolk to buy the hockey boots I needed as I made the transition to secondary school. For my mother, the only possible shop to buy them from was Lily White's. It wasn't that sport shops didn't exist in East Anglia, rather that going to that particular store represented a rite of passage for her. She spoke wistfully of Lyons Tea Shop and corner houses and told me how she used to visit them in her Sunday best with her beloved only sister, after whom I was named. Here they would exchange wartime confidences behind steamed up windows or assess a new boyfriend while a better class of waitress, the Nippy, hovered nearby, always on the move and careful not to show that she had heard everything that had been said. Once I started to go to the capital alone and eventually to live there, I collected my own Piccadilly memories. It was the obvious place to meet friends before we went to see a film or ventured into Soho's alleyways to find somewhere to eat or drink. As I emerged from the depths of the tube station, with its elegant columns and shiny floors, to the brilliance of Piccadilly Circus's shop windows and glowing adverts, I had to make a conscious effort to compose my face, to resist the impulse to ooh and ah. I've never lost that feeling of wonder. Piccadilly Circus is the ideal meeting place because it has turned gatherings into an art form. The constant comings and goings offer rich pickings for anyone who enjoys people watching, and its position at the confluence of so many distinct areas means you're just as likely to rub shoulders with an actor as you are with a sex worker, that you'll be in a sea of tourists, but also in the midst of people who view themselves as quintessential Londoners. You'll pass chambermaids on the way to turn back the covers on luxury beds and guests ready to dive into them. Shop assistants on their lunch break and shoppers hell-bent on spending. The area was a 24/7 sort of place, long before that term existed. Decades ahead of round-the-clock news, it was thrilling to know that you could buy the next day's paper from a vendor who would cut the string holding the bundle of newspapers together with a knife used solely for that purpose before he handed you tomorrow's headlines. I always found it reassuring too that if the bright lights had given you a headache, Boots the chemist was there for out-of-hours pain relief. Even the birds, who continued to chirrup as you approached Leicester Square after dark from Coventry Street, recognised that they have entered a world where normal rules don't apply. When I worked in a magazine office in nearby Soho, Piccadilly Circus acted as a bridge between that sleazy part of London and the Mayfair that I knew was out of my league socially. It was a liminal space where anything went and where, for a night at least, you could be someone else. I remember eating in a new restaurant near Piccadilly Circus with a friend from work. There was something different about the venue, but we couldn't quite put our finger on it. It wasn't until the main course arrived that we realised that we were the only diners not in drag. We were underdressed, but welcomed. It didn't seem at all surprising that, when we searched for the restaurant a few weeks later, it had vanished into thin air.
I think that encapsulates it so beautifully. And I love the way you write this first bit, you know, directly talking about your own experiences to the reader and then go into the history of it. And I'm sure that for me, that made me nostalgic just for, I remember coming up when I was little, to when we didn't live in London, coming up with my mum and going to John Lewis, that would be that kind of Lily White's type experience. And those memories that you have from your childhood are so, you know, incredible of, you know, that going to London or to going to any new place. Well, you know, I love the way you managed to convey that.
Thank you. Well, it was funny because my daughter's now a student in London, and we went to see something at the Criterion Theatre, and she just dyed her hair pink. And someone came bounding up to her, some young woman. I thought, oh, she's going to ask for money, you know, because that happens so often in London. Yeah. And this woman said, I love your hair, it's fantastic. And then just breathed off. And that kind of summed up Piccadilly Circus, because it was that kind of chance encounter and it was just so nice.
Yeah.
And then when we did go to the theatre, the Criterion, it's below street level. And you can feel and hear the tube, which is amazing as well.
Yes, it is amazing. I love that feeling.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite disturbing. But you think, this is a place that really shouldn't work because it's got so many things going on, but it does work really well.
Yeah, I whenever I'm in a theatre, so several theatres where you can feel the tube, I feel like I'm really in the heart of London. I love that feeling. It's wonderful. The Criterion is a wonderful theatre. Tell us about the Criterion building, because it's such an amazing place.
Yes, well, again, it works on different levels. And the Criterion restaurant was a massive building, and it was had tea rooms and different dining halls, and it was where Vera Brittain went with her fiancé and met her future mother-in-law, hopefully. So it was, and suffragettes met there and had meetings. So it was kind of, and apparently the ladies' toilets were very nice. So again, it was a place that people from different classes could meet. There was also a bar in the Criterion where gay people could go and feel very happy and comfortable. And that was also the same for the corner house. There was a place called the Lily Pond, which was reserved for gay people and in the 1920s, and they went there and felt safe, and, you know, at a time when to be a practicing homosexual was illegal, but yeah, you could go and be yourself in Piccadilly Circus, which I think is a wonderful thing.
And who was that set up by?
So the Lyons Company set up the tea rooms and the corner house, and I suppose it's something that kind of safe corner, that haven, just evolved.
Wow.
Going there regularly, and the rest of the nippies thought, well, that's cool, really, you know, they're paying, they've got every right to be here, which is kind of a way that Piccadilly Circuit is quite democratic as well, I think.
And I would love to be able to go back and go to a Lyons Corner House or a Lyons Tea House. I don't know if anybody here has any memories of them. I don't know when they stopped, but it's been something that I've always wanted to do. And when you go to the Museum of London, they have a recreation of a Lyons Tea Shop, and I just wish they had a real one. I keep waiting for some entrepreneur to set up the new Lyons, because I think we need it.
Yes, well, I think they did try to stage a comeback, and it just didn't work. And I don't think it, well, maybe it could work, but on a much smaller level, because they used to be, you know, across the country, but now with well-known coffee houses, you know, you could get your flat white in a Lyons. But and often think I don't think I would have wanted to be a nippy, because I'm not very good at maths, and and you had to be so neat. But I just think their uniform was just so stylish.
Yes. It was really stylish. We have a comment here bringing back so many memories that I'd forgotten about with a smiley face.
Oh, that's fun.
So where did you research things like that? Did you go to places like the Museum of London? I know you said you managed to do a lot online.
Yes, so I did make these dashes to the London Metropolitan Archives, and they've got amazing records to do with nippies. So Lyons did ask people to write in with their memories, and it's just so touching, this, you know, really spidery writing.
Yeah. Gorgeous.
you know, that it was so important to many people. So young girls would come to London and find a job there. And it was very kind of paternalistic. And the other people working there would look after the young people, and you'd be a trippy, and then you progress to a nippy. And just making friends with other people, and the excitement of going home in the dark. And, you know, there was always the hope you might meet a husband. And if you did, Lions would buy you your wedding cake. And
oh, my goodness.
And everyone had a story of a nippy who'd met a film star who came in. And there were stories about spies meeting in tea rooms as well. So it was a really, really exciting place to be. And when it first opened in the 1890s, they said they wanted only women with size 17-inch waists and red hair. And that thankfully went by the by. But they were
red hair. That was fantastic. Everyone else was discriminating against people with red hair. So how fantastic that they weren't.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And they went on strike in the 1890s. And the headline, I think, was A Storm in a Teacup, of course. So they were really interesting women. And their accounts are left in the London Metropolitan Archives. That was fantastic. I went to the Imperial War Museum and listened to accounts of the, because I mentioned I was interested in the bombing of the Café de Paris, and there are lots of accounts there of particularly Ballard Berkeley, who was in Fawlty Towers. He was the old buffer in that. So he was an actor at the time, but he was also an auxiliary police officer, and he turned up after the bombing, and there was a lot of looting that went on.
Yeah,
it was completely covered up, and there were people in there who thought that people were coming to feel their pulse to see if they were all right, but they were stripping watches and jewellery from them.
It's like in the scene from Les Miserables.
Yes, yeah, really, really scary. And then other people, nurses doing what they could with soda siphons and champagne and ripping up gorgeous gowns to make bandages. But a very odd kind of setting because of the nature of the bomb, it looked as though some people were completely unscathed. So they might be sitting there with a champagne bottle, but they were dead. Wow. And other people who had chosen that moment to powder their nose or make a phone call, and they escaped. So, you know, there were lots of stories ever after about people saying, I was going to go to the Café de Paris that night, but something made me think not to. So I love the idea of kind of it being a moment of chance and hubris as well. The fact that, you know, claimed it was blitzproof. So listening to those accounts and reading accounts was wonderful. Yes, just taking everything where I could, really. The National Archives I managed to get to, so there are lots of accounts there of who was on the scene then, and all the sources you would normally consult in a book of this nature.
So we've got a few comments here. I used to visit an old lady who worked at Swan and Edgar during the war, serving in the restaurant. She and her friends would enjoy going to tea dances with off-duty soldiers.
Oh, that must have been fantastic.
Love that. It's kind of oral history. It's wonderful. Yeah. Yes. Another comment here, the Criterion Theatre is absolutely beautiful, a whole new world underground.
Yes, it definitely is.
And another comment here, I went on a school trip in 1964 to London, which included a lunch in a Lion's Corner house. Oh. It was wonderful. We all felt very posh at the time. Oh, I'm envious. I've always wanted to go to one. Keep hoping that one day they'll be set up.
Yes.
Now, we've talked a lot about Piccadilly, which is this gorgeous new book here. Available, I put a link in, available from all good bookshops and online and on Kindle and however you choose your books. But you've written several other books as well. So you've written two biographies, for example. You've written Marie Lloyd and Amy Johnson. Tell us a little bit about these two fascinating women.
Yes. So I have a pile of them here. So this is Marie Lloyd. So she was a very interesting woman. And actually, it's this year is the... So she died in 1922. So last year was the centenary of her death. So I went to this amazing memorial service in Hampstead by the British Musical Society. It was just amazing. So she was this incredible woman who sang quite kind of risque songs, but you could look at the lyrics and think they're very tame, but she could make anything sound absolutely filthy and, you know, employ a wink to great effect. She married three times. She toured America, Australia, South Africa. And when she died very young, actually, well, 52, she collapsed on stage and didn't recover from that coma. Around 100,000 people came to her funeral. And there was one woman who walked from Newmarket in Suffolk to be there in Hampstead. So she was kind of, people really related to her and thought she was this very warm person. She was very charismatic. She died with very little money because she gave it all away. Her final husband was a champion jockey. He was about 17 years younger than her. She was banned from the first Royal Command performance because of her risque nature, and unfortunately two of her husbands she was the victim of domestic abuse. So a very interesting woman. So I wrote about her, and I managed to get her back into the Piccadilly book because of she performed at the Pavilion, which is on Piccadilly Circus, and it's that classical building, the frontage of which is still there. Mm-hmm. And she got her gowns from Swan and Edgar. And then Amy Johnson, have I got her here? Yes. So I wrote that about her. She was known as the typist from Hull, and she was the first woman to fly solo from England to Australia in 1930. And she also shopped at Swan and Edgar, which is great, and went to Lyons tea shops to chat with her family as well. And she was this beautiful woman in the 1930s and disappeared in 1941 over the Thames estuary during the Second World War. So lots of adventure there, quite a different story. Yeah.
And the controversy around her death still seems to reign, doesn't it? Like every now and then another news story comes out. It's a real unsolved mystery, isn't it?
Yes. Well, she was going to, she was never going to be someone who died in their bed, you know. But I was still involved in a conversation on Twitter recently about someone saying, oh, there was a story a few years ago about a gunner who recently said, oh, I think I shot her down. I don't think I'm sure he's not lying, but I don't think he could have done because of the distances and all sorts of things. And I just think that she was, so she was coming down from Blackpool, she was ferrying a plane and aiming for Kidlington near Oxfordshire. So the Thames estuary is way off where she should have been. But it was really appalling. Whether it's in January, and a figure did bail out, her body was never found. But I just think it was a case of her being in appalling weather when she shouldn't really have gone out that day. But you know, try telling someone like Amy Johnson that the weather's bad and they should stay at home.
Well, maybe she bailed out, maybe she escaped, and maybe she's done all sorts of fascinating things ever since. You could write a whole series on what Amy did next.
Yeah, I did. I did a talk once, and someone said that they thought that she'd gone off with Glenn Miller, who also disappeared in an aeroplane. So, who knows, really?
Slightly different geographic region, wasn't it, where Glenn Miller disappeared?
Yeah, yeah.
Don't let that spoil a good story, though. Yeah. That's your next. That's your series, Amy and Glenn. So we've got a comment here. There's a beautiful statue of Amy Johnson on the Herne Bay seafront. You're nodding, you obviously.
There certainly is. There's a beautiful statue there. And one of my ambitions is at some stage to go down there with my dog and take a picture of, because lots of people take a picture of there. And so it looks like Amy's holding the dog's lead. So I think that's something I should do. Perhaps this year.
So you've written some really wonderful books about women who've been kind of forgotten before. Mm. So we've got Army Wives from Crimea to Afghanistan, The Real Lives of the Women Behind the Men in Uniform, and Waiting for Hitler, Voices from Britain on the Brink of Invasion. Tell us about those two. And what there's obviously a real interest there in wartime history and
time. Yeah. So this is Waiting for Hitler. And it's really about that period in 1940. If you think of the beginning of Dad's Army, where the arrows are just across the channel and it's about to happen. And when I was writing about Amy Johnson, I was reading her letters and she was talking about the fall of France and saying, I can't believe we're on the point of invasion. And I'd never really realised how close things were. And it made me think, it was also when Baghdad was invaded, and I live in a part of the world where you can hear planes going over from where the American air bases were. And I thought it must have been so awful to think that you're about to be overrun by Nazis. And a friend of mine said her mother had got enough poison in to kill her family because she didn't want them to live in a country run by Nazis. So I wanted to try and recreate that period. So I did a lot of reading of the mass observation diaries.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it was great because Norfolk at that point was kind of on the front line because they were expecting, as the Nazis swept through Europe, that the invasion might come from there and from the south coast, and how the landscape of the country changed as you couldn't go to the seaside. there was pillboxes everywhere. Golf courses were dug up because they were perfect landing places. There were lots of great rumours about nuns being spies and parachutists about to arrive. And there was a complete rumour about the nun with the hairy arm. So there'd be lots of stories of Noel Stretfield wrote Ballet Shoes, said that she'd heard this rumour that someone had been on the bus with a nun and they had reached out to offer their ticket and had a very hairy arm. So we're obviously a Nazi.
Obviously a Nazi spy. That's a story that I think even when I was little used to still be talked about. Well, the hitchhiker with the hairy arm who's supposed to be an elderly woman. And something that's always used to terrify people.
Yes. And also the kind of sad way of how in enemy aliens, as they were known, were interned. And they often were people who had escaped Nazi Germany and were genuinely anti-Nazi. So a very kind of troubling time. And very interesting to write about a short period in time. So at the fall of the Low Countries, so in spring of 1940, and then the start of the Blitz in the autumn of that year. So when it became, and the tide and the weather changed, and so an invasion was less likely. So I like writing about periods that have a kind of an inbuilt drama in their story.
Yeah, and the army wives.
Yeah,
one. I mean that spans when you say Afghanistan, I assume you mean Afghanistan today. So that's a really fascinating broad scope of history.
Yeah, and I found that really interesting because before that, the book I'd done before was about prisoners of war.
Yes,
so this one because my father was a prisoner of war, and it's a book about. What people did in a creative sense, in a kind of counterintuitive way. So it's about people who learnt to new skills. So I managed to speak to Clive Dunn because he had been a POW. And again, he's one of my absolute heroes. And he had quite a tough time, but managed to act. And he said that when he was out working in horrible conditions, he then used that anger when he... would portray his character in Dad's Army, the kind of, pent up anger from how he'd felt as a POW. So that book was about people who learned to draw or paint or took up acting careers, took exams, made incredible medical advances when they were in camps, which is something that I didn't know much about at all before I did the book. And Army Wives, again, I found really interesting. And perhaps, so I enjoyed writing about things like the Crimea, but I also enjoyed writing about what it's like to be an army wife now. And I thought it was very interesting to think about how we communicate, because now we've obviously got instant communication through FaceTime and what we're doing now. But actually that can be really difficult, because if you're writing a letter, you're quite circumspect about what you say, but now it's instant. So you might talk to your loved one and say, I'm really struggling with my son's homework, or your mother-in-law's really annoying me, or the washing machine is broken. You probably wouldn't put much of that in a letter. And then the person at the other end is helpless to do anything about it. So it's quite stressful.
Yeah.
With something like Facebook, the person who's away from home can see that you claim you're missing them, but actually he can see or she can see that you've been out at a nightclub or having a great time. So I think it's really interesting how communication changes and perhaps isn't always for the best.
Yeah. Oh, this has all been so fascinating. I'm going to finish by talking to you about the place that we met, which is the Institute of Continuing Education at Cambridge University. I'm going to tell us a little bit about that and your role there, because you also teach.
Yes, I do. So I've taught there for over 20 years, which is really scary. And all the courses are part-time. And I love it because we have a range of students. So my ideal classroom, and Lucinda, I think you probably feel the same, is where you've got maybe someone who's just left university, someone who's working, someone who's in their 80s or even 90s. And to have the discussions and the life experiences in that room, there's just nothing like it, really. So
absolutely brilliant to have that wide range and geographic range now as well.
Yeah. So the certificates and the diplomas are online. So we do have people around the world, which is just amazing as well. We offer a master's in creative writing, which is again part-time and is you physically come to Madingley Hall, and we have a master's in writing performance too as well. So it's really grown dramatically, and our alumni include people like Sarah Collins, who wrote The Confessions of Fanny Langton, and that grew out of her dissertation on the master's. Yeah, and it's just a really exciting place to be. So and Madingley Hall is a beautiful place. As you finally know, because you've got
Know, yes. Midge first commissioned me to start working there in 2019. I was meant to be starting in 2020. So guess what? It wasn't at Madingley. It was all online. And I finally got the chance last year to go to Madingley Hall. And what a beautiful place. So yes, definitely recommend that if you're near Cambridge, go and see this gorgeous place. Thank you, Midge. It has been an absolute joy having you here today. And everybody, here it is, Piccadilly, the Circus at the Heart of London. Wonderful book. I really recommend it. Very, very easy to read and fun to read. And it will bring back, as people have said in their comments, lots of nostalgia.
Well, thank you for having me, Lucinda. I've had a great time.
Good. Come back to Goldster when your next book comes out.
I'd love to.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.